Well, I always, always enjoy Father Heaton's sermons, not only because of the fact that it means that I'm not preaching, which is very self-serving, but I thought that his sermon last week on Acts 15 was fantastic. Anytime that somebody can work in a supermassive black hole into a sermon, that's no small feat. So we are almost to the end of our series on the Acts of the Apostles, and I, for one, am sad. I've enjoyed the study so much, and I hope that you have done as well. We do have two more after today, but we have made our way very efficiently, if not deliberately, through the Acts of the Apostles, and we have seen how it is that after Jesus himself ascended into heaven, that the apostles go about the business of spreading the news that there is a new king in town. And Luke, writing the Acts of the Apostles, deliberately shows his hand from the very first chapter, that Jesus commissions his disciples to go out and begin in the city of Jerusalem, then Judea and Samaria, and to all the ends of the earth. And of course, all of the ends of the earth includes the Gentile masses that had been longtime strangers to the one true God. But as we saw this past Sunday, how it was that the apostles understood how the Word of God was going out mightily. The Spirit was bringing in numerously the thousands and tens of thousands of Gentiles. And this itself was a sign that Jesus' ministry was true, that God had kept his promises to Israel, and now the nations were coming in. And so, as we have seen the drama of this book develop, the apostles faced the persecution and rejection of the Jews by the martyrdom of Stephen, the persecution of Saul, and finally, the terrible oppression by Herod Agrippa I, killing James, and then, of course, imprisoning Peter, who was miraculously released from prison. And then, as we've seen initially, the gospel has begun to go out into the nations. The Ethiopian eunuch believes the gospel when Philip tells him the good news. And Cornelius, of course, a great lover of the Jewish people and a follower of the true faith, and he providing financially for the care and maintenance of his local synagogue. Now he and his whole family hear the gospel of Jesus the Messiah and is brought in through baptism. And so the word goes out to Samaria, to Tyre and to Sidon, up the coastline there and out into the nearest island, Cyprus. And then we hear of the drama of the council at Jerusalem. The conclusion, of course, by all of the apostles, that the Gentiles must come in as they are, that circumcision is no longer binding upon them, but that they should remember to stop acting like pagans. That was the takeaway. Quit acting like pagans. You've been brought into the life of God's redeemed family. So stop acting like you haven't been. This new life now has been poured out upon you. So act no longer as though you were simply in the old man. And so now, in the mind of Luke and the drama of his book unfolding before us, we should be tracking the progression of the gospel. That the gospel has challenged to the face the greatest religion the world had ever known, Judaism. And now it has gone out into the Gentile nations with great success. And now Paul comes into Europe. The chapter that we sadly were not able to read together, chapter 16, recounts how Paul and Silas crossed over that very narrow water course there, known variously as the Hellespont or the Dardanelles there, that separate Asia from Europe, crossed over into Macedonia. And while we might not think of the Greeks and Macedonians as being Europeans, all of us very, for the most part, pale-faced, fair-skinned Northern Europeans here, but they are Europeans. The gospel comes to Europe in the hands of Paul and Silas. And as he progresses through those towns in northern Macedonia, there, if you have that map in your head, all of my classically trained students around here should know this part of the map that I'm talking about. Great success, and yet the Jews in the synagogues reject Paul and Silas and not only throw them out, but chase them through the countryside, even to the next town of Berea. So finally, Paul's friends and supporters pack him away and sneak him out of Berea down to Athens so that he can be safe from his enemies. And there, in the mind of Luke, stands Paul at the very heart of the greatest city of pagan philosophical thought that the world had ever done and known. We shouldn't miss that. The drama that Luke unfolds before us. The gospel has taken the world by storm. Judaism cannot stand before it. And now the gospel must be preached to the great wise men of the world. The gospel must take its place and confront that great body of knowledge and of wisdom. Will it be victorious? Yes, it will. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson went on a camping trip one day, and in the middle of the night, Holmes nudged Watson and said to Watson, "Wake up, Watson. Watson, look up at the sky and tell me what you see." Watson lit his pipe and dragged on it thoughtfully and said, "Well, Holmes, I see millions of stars." And Holmes said to Watson, "What do you infer from these stars, Watson?" Watson thought carefully, knowing that Holmes was putting him to the test, and said, "Well, a number of things. Astronomically, I observed there are millions of galaxies and billions of stars and planets. Astrologically, I observe that Saturn is in Leo. Horologically, I deduce that the time is approximately 3:15 in the morning. Meteorologically, I expect that the weather will be fine and clear this upcoming day. Theologically, I deduce that God is all-powerful and that man is his creation, yet small and insignificant. What do you deduce, Holmes?" And Holmes looked at him and said, "Watson, you fool. Someone has stolen our tent." Philosophy humor is just as bad as religious humor, I know. But the fact is that we have to take just a few minutes this morning. I promise not to digress too far, but a few minutes to talk about philosophy. Luke wants us to be thinking about that very thing. Paul stands in the midst of Athens, the home of the greatest philosophical tradition the world had ever seen, and Luke includes the fact that he noticed all around him the representatives of the two great schools of thought, the Epicureans and the Stoics, who were standing about doing philosophy. The Epicureans had taught that the gods were true, there were deities, but they were far, far away. And they were so far away that they couldn't be bothered with what was going on here on earth. And perhaps because of that, they were happy. If they were closer and saw what was going on, they might not have been so happy. But nonetheless, the Epicureans were convinced that the gods did exist, but they didn't really have any interest in what was going on down here. And they lived lives of peace and tranquility and happiness. And a virtuous man, or woman, or child, here on earth, should do like they're doing. Being peaceful, quiet, pursuing happiness, but in moderation. That was what virtue for the Epicurean was like. They're often tarred as being bacchanalians, as though the Epicureans just said they go out and party all the time, but that's not true. The Epicureans believed that that the goal of human life was to be happy, but that should be done as the gods were doing, which was in peace, moderation, and tranquility. The Stoics, on the other hand, did not believe that the gods existed per se, but they were pantheists or panentheists, which means that they believed that there was a divine power, but that divine power was in everything. There was no other divinity outside the world that could be observed. That the divine spark was in everyone and everything. And so the virtuous man or woman was to attempt through the philosophical process, but through meditation, to get in touch with the divine spark that was within each one of us. And in fact, doing the right thing, the virtuous thing, in the midst of the obvious destruction all around. The Stoics were convinced of the idea that the world was doomed, but that wasn't a reason to not do the right thing. In fact, that proved that you were truly virtuous if you were convinced that the world was falling apart at the seams and couldn't be saved, and yet, with that kind of gritty, perhaps British, stiff upper lip, to do the right thing anyway. The Epicureans and the Stoics. And Paul took the stage and began to tell these philosophers that there was a new god in town. As a matter of fact, two new gods in town. One of them was named Jesus, and the other one's name was Anastasia. Now, you only get the joke if you know Greek, which I don't know as much as Father Heaton, but here it is. Paul wasn't talking about two new gods, but he was talking about Jesus and resurrection. The word for resurrection is Anastasis, which the Greeks thought he was talking about another god, or in this case, a goddess. And that worked for them because their gods usually came in pairs. So Jesus was a new god, and he had a female consort. Her name was Anastasia, or resurrection. And they didn't quite understand. We hear the language of these Greeks here translated so nicely in our English that it sounds like they are interested in perhaps a new philosophy. But it's unlikely that that's the case. Of course, it's a question of syntax and, of course, a question of how you read the sentence here presented to us. But, and of course, Gale has always such a lovely delivery here. But they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, that is the courtroom of Athens, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean." Now, that way, it just sounds like they're, you know, perhaps holding a cocktail in one hand and a bunch of flowers in the other, and they're just glad for a visitor to show up from far, far away. But it's probably not like that. As a matter of fact, it's more likely the fact that they were receiving Paul the way that they had received, well, Socrates. And we should be thinking about Socrates when we read this story. If you don't know, Socrates, the greatest thinker of the Greek tradition, who lived in the 3rd century BC, the 4th century, so the 300s BC, had been executed. He had been executed because he asked too many questions. He was constantly walking around. He was a bit of a vagabond, as a matter of fact. And he was asking people just all kinds of uncomfortable questions that they couldn't answer. And so he was brought up on charges, two of them, as a matter of fact, atheism, that he did not show proper respect to the gods. And there we are, right? There's Paul. "I see that you are very religious." And also, because of his skepticism, that is, he was just constantly asking these questions, that he was leading the young men of Athens astray. He was causing them to be skeptical, to not respect the tradition of the Greeks. Two charges: atheism and leading the young astray. He was executed, well, invited to drink poison, which was the way that they executed people in Athens in his day. So to my point being that it's unlikely that we've got just simply the visitors' information representatives here in Athens welcoming this new traveler from far away, but instead they hear him teaching about new gods and are suspicious and have dragged him into court, which is exactly what the Areopagus was. They were suspicious of him in the same way that they had been of Socrates some 400 years earlier. But Paul answers them in their own language. He begins by asking them, did not one of your own poets say that we are all children of God? But if that's the case, if we are all children of God, look about you. I mean, we're people. We're not made out of stone. We're not made out of metal. If it's the case that human beings or persons are the children of a God, then that God must also be a person, not made out of stone or metal. And if that's the case, and your own poets and philosophers say that it is, then that person must be knowable. Now, I see that you have a shrine built to the unknown God, but let me tell you, he wants to be known, and he has made himself known right here, right now. He has made himself known in the person named Jesus. And that Jesus now has been raised to the right hand of the one true God. And he has now taken his role up to judge the earth. Judgment is not something that we feel real confident about. We have come through the Protestant Reformation through to the other side. We're all pretty well convinced that we're not saved by works, but by grace. And by virtue of that, any kind of language about judgment makes us feel really anxious, right? Because we admit on the front end of things that we can't do anything to save ourselves. And so we're pretty sure that if we come under judgment, it's going to go bad for us, badly for us. But that's not the Jewish conviction. Paul's conviction was that judgment was something that human beings, but especially God's people, should be mightily excited about. If God is just, and God keeps his promises, and he promises to love his people, and if God is in the business of raising the dead back to life again, then judgment should be exactly the kind of thing that human beings are looking for. If we look out around the world and acknowledge how broken things are, we acknowledge the fact that we have no power to fix it. Who can fix the world? The Jews, and Paul with them, would say, only God can. And when he fixes the world, that will be the sign of his judgment. His judgment bringing truth to bear, bringing life out of death, putting down the powers of darkness and destruction, and raising up life from the grave. This will be the sign of God's judgment. And Paul says, this moment has come upon you, O philosophers. Now we might say, isn't that nice? That's all well and good. But the fact of the matter was is that the Greeks did not share this idea of judgment. C.S. Lewis, in his work on the Iliad and the Odyssey, talks about how it is that the one reflection that he took away from reading the Iliad was the sense of doom. The Greeks didn't believe that there would ever be a resolution, that the world would go on and on and on, and it would be remarkable by great heroic acts, but also the powerful crushing the weak. And Lewis uses one word to describe that: doom. There would be no judgment. It would only be doom. But Paul stands in the midst of the Greeks and says, ah, but there will be a judgment, that the true God will vindicate his children. He will come and he will defeat the powers of doom, of darkness, and of death, and of destruction, and he will bring forth into the world the power of life, of anastasis, of resurrection. This the Greeks did not get right. And Paul says, you now know the true God has come and he will judge the world. He has been forgiving and gracious and merciful, long-suffering. He hasn't brought his judgment against you. He has not held against you your wayward thoughts and ways, your idolatries in the past. But now the time has come. I'm here to tell you that his son, Jesus, has been raised from the dead. And because he has been raised from the dead, he is now king over all the earth. So Paul could write to the Corinthians a little bit later than in our epistle this morning. I was interested to see the convergence here. But Paul writes in the 15th chapter of his letter to the Corinthians, another Greek church, Christ is the first fruits. Then at his coming, those who belong to Christ will be raised. Then comes the end, when he delivers the kingdom to God, the Father, after destroying every rule and every authority and every power. For he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. And the last enemy to be defeated will be death. This to the Greeks. He has been raised, and so he is king. And because he is king, all those who follow him will also rise from the dead. But not only will they rise from the dead, but all of his enemies, all principalities and powers, all forces of death and darkness, they will be defeated as well. Did you know that we're all Epicureans now? You may not feel like an Epicurean today, but we're all Epicureans now. The air, the water, the world around us, we're all Epicureans now. It's a result of the Enlightenment, that age of reason in which we all discovered vast amounts of scientific empirical knowledge, the scientific push that makes the world that we live in a wonderful place. I'm so glad that y'all invented penicillin. I thank the doctors for all of your work. I would hate to have died as a child with a nasty ear infection and a raging bacterial infection that would have killed me in my childhood. I'm so thankful for that. So I don't want you to hear me being some kind of grouch and enemy of scientific research and advancement. But the fact of the matter is that our attitude as it relates to the world around us now has pushed God far, far, far out into his heavens, the way that the Epicureans believed that they were. God no longer has a place here on this earth. This earth is dominated by reason, by science, by industry, by technology. If you can't prove it, it must not be real. And you can't prove God. So he may exist. We'll be benign in our skepticism. We'll say, he probably does exist. He just doesn't exist here. He's just so far away, and he's not really interested in what we're doing right now. That's the world that we live in today. Did you know that you lived in an Epicurean world? So what are your alternatives here now that we have acknowledge the fact that we are all Epicureans now? Well, one is that we just go with the flow, which is that science and the power that comes from science rules. So Darwin now is our prophet, and I guess evolution is our God, right? The strong survive. That's the meaning of life, materialism. The strong survive. Of course, it really stinks if you're not the strong. You're the weak. You're just going to, well, get pushed out of the way. An alternative to that is what we meet often in the churches today, which is that we acknowledge the fact that God is far, far away in his heavens, and he wants us to be saved. And so if we believe in him, then when we die, we get to go far, far away and be with him. God's not much interested in this world because this world's broken. So what we need to do as Christians is to have faith, be converted, and when we believe, then we get to go on the great big rocket ship to take us off of this planet, to go far, far away, because God can't do anything about this world. This world is broken. You see how both of those work, even if you're Epicurean? God's far away. So either he doesn't exist, or you need to go far away to get to him. But Paul doesn't seem to be interested in accepting either of those alternatives. Neither alternative is open to us in the Acts of the Apostles. Paul leads with this. God made the world, so it's his, and he's not willing to give it up. So deal with it. That's what Paul says. God has made the world and everybody in it, and he intends to rescue it. In him we live and move and have our being, and he has brought his judge back from the dead to show that he owns the world. There is no power in this world that can stop his divine plan and claim to this world. The church's proclamation can never be simply to get people saved. Paul's claim is that we need to make sure that everybody knows that the king rules here and now in this place. You see, the business of the church is not to get people saved. The business of the church is resurrection. It's resurrection. It's bringing back the dead to life. It is to break down the idols of this world that Paul saw all around him in Athens. I see by all of the idols along the roads that you are a very religious people, he says to the Athenians. That is the business of the church, breaking down the idols of this world, the idols of sex, Venus, Aphrodite. She was very powerful in Paul's day. To destroy that idol, to restore human beings to godly understandings of not only their own bodies, but also the blessings of marriage and of children. This is an idol to be destroyed by the church. The god of Mars, that is the god of warfare, of power, and of violence. This is an idol to be destroyed by the church. Jesus is the King of Peace. He's called us to bring peace to the world, raising the powerless up from the dust, to bring his peace to reign in this world. The power of Mammon, the god of money. Don't you know how we are crushed by hundreds of millions of dollars of debt that can never, ever be repaid? And the only people that survive an economic cataclysm like that are the banks that are too big to fail. And all of the rest of us just keep on paying. But the fact of the matter is that debt, God, must be destroyed by the God who brings the world back to life. That God must be destroyed by the church. We must reach out to people who are broken in poverty, in body, and by the powers that be, and we must show them the life of the resurrection. This is the claim. This is the call of Paul the Athenians, and we, these 2,000 years later, must hear it again. Amen.